We're reading from Ivan Doig's book, Last Bus to Wisdom, The Adventures of a Lad Named Donald, no D on the end, who's being sent off on a long Greyhound bus trip to live with his aunt and uncle, people he's never even met. It's a story told through the eyes, memory, and imagination of an 11-year-old going on 12 boy. On the bus, to his utter surprise, he just met a waitress from the little Montana town from which he came, a woman who had regularly put flowers on roadside crosses put up for his parents, who were killed in a car wreck. We're in Chapter 3. White as bones, the roadside trio of short metal crosses stood in memoriam on the long slope up from the Two Medicine River, one for my father, one for my mother, and although I could not see why he deserved the same, one for the drunk driver whose pickup drifted across the center line and hit theirs head-on. Only once had I seen the crosses, on a school trip on the Blackfoot Museum in Browning not long after the funeral, and I had to swallow sobs the rest of the trip. I almost wish the American Legion Post would quit marking highway deaths like that, for some of us, too much of a reminder. But my father had been a favorite at Legion Halls, someone who came out of the D-Day landing badly wounded but untouched in his personality, ready with a laugh and a story any time he and my mother blew in for a drink and a nice supper and some dancing. The flowers, which I remembered were yellow, must have been Graham's own ongoing remembrance, by courtesy, a great deal more than that, of Letty Minetti. A jolt went through me like touching the hot wire of something electric. Connected by accident, she and I were no longer simply strangers on a bus. Wherever she was headed with her name on her uniform, it was not to work the counter at the Browning truck stop 100 miles in the other direction. You do that anymore? I rushed out the words, then hedged. The flowers, I mean? Letty shook her head and lit the interrupted cigarette. Couldn't. Sorry. Been in the falls a year or so, she expelled along with a stream of smoke, busting my tail in the dining room at the Buster. You know it? Surprisingly, I did. The Sodbuster Hotel was a fancy place where the Williamsons stayed during the Great Falls Rodeo, so Wendell could oversee, or, according to Graham, mess with, the handling of the Double W's string of bucking horses. My new confidant let out her breath, nothing to do with smoking this time. Didn't work out. I'll tell you something. The more dressed up people are, the harder they are to wait on. Laughing as she said it, but not the amused kind. I missed the Browning gang. The Rez boys tip real good when they have a few drinks in them, and you'd be surprised. And truckers leave their change on the counter. It adds up. What wasn't adding up was her presence on this bus with the rest of us nomads, so I outright asked, "What are you doing on here in this direction?" She flicked me a look, but answered readily enough, "Taking a job in Hover, Newtown, fresh start. That's the way it goes." That didn't sound good. People were always saying about Hover off by itself, and not much going for it but the railroad that ran through. You can have her. Something of that reputation must have been on Letty's mind, too. "Hey, you know any French?" All river, maybe. "No, more than that. See, the place where I'll be working is called, capital T, the Le Havre Supper Club." She nibbled her lip. "Something doesn't seem quite right about that, don't you think? Anyway, that's why I'm wearing my work shirt," meaning the uniform top with the prominent stitching, "in case I have to go on shift right away. Some morons," she pronounced it morons, with the same note in her voice as when Graham would say sparrowhead, "put you to slinging coffee almost before you keister through the doorway, would you believe?" I made a sympathetic noise, but my attention wasn't in it. By now, I had a crush on her. Oh, man, my thinking ran. Wouldn't it be great if she and Graham could get a job together at the Top Spot Cafe back in Grosvenor, if Haver didn't pan out for her, and if Graham was as good as new after her operation, and if I made it through whatever waited in Wisconsin, and we could all share a real house together, not a cook shack right there in town? When you're as young as I was then, a world of any kind begins at the outskirts of your imagination, and you populate it with those who have proven themselves to you. The unknowns are always lying in wait, though. Trying not to, I kept glancing at Letty's hand and the wedding ring that showed itself with every drag on her cigarette. She caught me at it. "You don't miss much, do you?" She flexed that finger away from the others. "My husband's still in Browning. Tends bar there. Chases women on the side. We made a great pair." She shrugged as if the next didn't matter, although even I knew it was the kind of thing that always does. We split. He was jealous. There was this one trucker, Harv, I got a little involved with. Harv's some piece of work. She grinned in a way that said more than she was saying. The strong, silent type straight out of the movies, you know? Doesn't say much, but when he does, it's right on the money. The grin humorously tucked in on itself. Even looks a little like Gregory Peck if you close one eye a little. Then her face clouded. Trouble is, he's sort of hard to keep up with because he's on the road so much, trucking here and there. But when he's around, her voice dropped to a confidential level, sparks fly. "Holy wow," I said, as if I knew anything about such matters. "He sounds like a real boyfriend." "Real as they come." She blew a smoke ring as I drifted along in the romantic mood. "We're more or less engaged, or will be when that husband of mine gets it through his thick head to agree to a divorce." Dabbing the ash off her cigarette, she mused, "Haven't seen Harv lately, though. Hated to do it, but I had to leave word for him at the Buster that I had moved on to the Le Havre." Then her grin sneaked back infectiously. "Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Truer words were never. Harv's good at catching up on things." "I bet he is." I endorsed him sight unseen, talented as he sounded in areas a little beyond me. "Anyway, what's done is done," she said briskly. "You ought to have that in your book." She mashed out the latest cigarette. "Hey, enough of the story of my life. How's Dory these days? Why isn't she with you?" "She's got to have an operation." I poured out everything, the cook shack and the charity nuns and Wisconsin and all, my listener taking it in without saying anything. When I finally ran down, Letty bit her lip again. "Geez, that's rough on both of you. Tough deal all around." The bus changed speed as the driver shifted gears on a hill, bobbing us against our seat backs, and when that stopped, Letty still rocked back and forth a little. "You know what? You need something else to think about." Reaching in her purse, she took out a compact and redid her lipstick, which surprised me because she had already been wearing quite a gob, working her lips together to even it out the way women do. When she was satisfied, she snapped the compact shut and asked, "Ever been kissed?" Well, sure, I stammered. "Lots." "Besides nighty night?" Not really, I guess." "Scooch down a little like you're showing me something real interesting in the book there, and turn this way, and we'll do something about that." She craned around to make sure no one was watching, and I really hoped the nun wasn't. Dazed, I did as she said. And she did what she said, bringing her warm lips to mine in a kiss I felt to the tips of my ears. She tasted like tobacco and lipstick, but a lot more than that, too, although I was too young to put a name to such things. We broke apart, her first. "There you go, kiddo. That's for luck." Grinning broadly, she opened the compact again to show me myself plastered with the red imprint of her lips, as if I needed any evidence, before tenderly wiping away the lipstick with her hanky. "First of many smackaroos in your career," she said huskily. "You'll get good at it. Bets of booties you will. Now, you better scoot back to your own seat, sugar. We're just about there." That was true of her and the pink titty tatting that pointed the way. I was still trying to catch up with the dizzying twists and turns of the day. Chapter 4. "Have her, the Paris of the Prairie," the lanky driver called out in a mechanical way. "You may disembark if you so wish and stretch your legs. The Greyhound Bus Depot, proud to serve you, has full conveniences." To me, that meant the one that flushes, and with Graham's number one instruction for riding the dog bus in comparative comfort urgently in mind, "Every stop you make sure you get in there and go before the bus does," I was the first one off and into the station, fantastic Letty first giving me a goodbye pat on the cheek and wishing me all the luck in the world. I could have used some by the time I emerged from the men's restroom and tried to navigate the waiting room crowded with families of Indians and work gangs of white guys in bib overalls and a mix of other people, the mass of humanity causing me to duck and dodge and peer in search of something to eat. My meal money, a $5 bill that Graham had tucked into my jeans, was burning a hole in my pocket. Besides that, on the principle that you never want to be separated from your money while traveling among strangers, I had a stash under my shirt. 3 $10 bills that she had folded snugly and pinned behind the breast pocket with a large safety pin, assuring me that a pickpocket would need scissors for hands to reach it. These days, it's hardly conceivable that 3 perforated 10 spots and a fiver felt to me like all the cash in the world. But at a time when a cup of coffee cost only a dime, as did that stimulant for the younger set like me, comic books and a movie could be seen for a quarter, and a pair of blue jeans would set you back $2.50 at most. Be that as it may, besides providing me with a little to spend during the Wisconsin stay, mad money, Graham's words for it, probably fitting my tendencies all too accurately. The shirt stash was meant to outfit me with school clothes back there to come home as well. School clothes were a big deal then, no real family wanting to look stingy about it. So, scraping that much cash together to send me off with was no easy thing. It amounted to half Graham's last monthly paycheck from the tight fist of Sparrowhead, and that's why I had firm instructions from her to stretch the pocket fiver through the trip by confining lunches to a sandwich. No milkshake, no pieces of pie, no bottles of pop. In other words, no getting rambunctious with a tantalizing 5-spot. Which sounded okay in theory, but less so in a thronged bus depot when I was hungry as a wolf. Wouldn't you know that the lunch counter, offering greasy hamburgers if a person did not want runny egg salad sandwiches wrapped in wax paper, was jam-packed by the time I could get there, and service was slow as ring around the rosy. Haver really needed Letty. Desperately looking around as my stomach growled, I spied the newsstand that sold magazines and cigarettes and other sundries. Graham had not thought to say anything about candy bars. So I hurried over, one eye on the clock. No one else was buying anything, but the gum-chewing woman clerk had to tend to freight parcels as well as the candy counter, and it took a very long couple of minutes to get her to wait on me. "A Mounds bar, please. Dark chocolate with coconut inside. You can't beat that," I said as rapidly as I could. Then I remembered that supper time would not be until North Dakota, as distant to me as the cheese side of the moon. "Make it 3. The Greyhound had its motor running when I dashed out of the terminal, peeling a Mounds as I ran. The door was open, but the driver was resting a hand on the handle that operated it. "Cutting it pretty close, sonny," he said, giving me the stink eye as I panted up the steps, the door sucking shut behind me. To my amazement, the bus had filled up entirely, except where I had saved my window seat with my cord jacket. And if I could believe my eyes, there next to it sat a big-bellied Indian with black braids that came down over his shoulders. Oh, man, here was my chance. A seatmate I could talk to about all kinds of Indian things. The Fort Belknap Reservation was somewhere in this part of Montana, I knew, and he and the Indian families taking up about half the bus must be headed home there. My head buzzed with a sensation of double luck. Here delivered right to me was not only someone really great for the autograph book, but who could palaver? That's what Indians did, didn't they? With me about the Black Arrowhead, if I went about it right. What a break! "Hi," I chirped as I joined him. "Howdy," he said in a thrilling, deep voice that reverberated up out of that royal belly. Maybe he was a chief, too, as he moved his legs enough for me to squeeze by to my window seat. The bus lurched into immediate motion, as if my fanny hitting the cushion was a signal to go, and I settled into eating my candy bar and sneaking looks sideways at my traveling companion. He was dressed not all that different from me, blue jeans and a western shirt with snap buttons. All resemblance ended there, though. His buckskin face could have posed for the one on Nichols. Then there were those braids. I envied him his straw cowboy hat, beat up and curled over almost on itself at the brim, and darkly sweat-stained from what I would have bet was life on one of the small ranches scattered around the reservation, riding Appaloosa horses and hunting antelope and dancing at powwows and a million other things that beat anything I had been through at the Double W. Mind your manners no matter what, so people don't think you were born in a barn. I could all but hear Graham reciting that in my ear, so I politely turned away to the window to wait until we were out of town and freewheeling toward the reservation before striking up a conversation about him being an Indian and my second name or nickname or whatever it was being Red Chief. That ought to get palaver going. Then, when obsidian arrowheads became the topic, should I tell him just sort of casually that I had one in my suitcase? For all I knew, possessing such a rarity maybe made a person special in the tribe. Possibly I was already a sort of honorary chieftain, didn't know it, from whatever sacred quality, to me that meant pretty much the same as magic, a glistening dark treasure like that carried. Yet there was another consideration, wasn't there? While I was surer than sure that Wendell Williams did not deserve an arrowhead older than Columbus, what about the Indians from that time on? What if my braided seatmate were to tell me that the black arrowhead was a lucky piece that they worshipped, and there was a whole long story about how tough life had been for the Indians ever since it was lost? I'd feel bad about having it. I decided I'd better play it safe at first and start with his autograph. Finally, the bus labored out of the last of Haver, and we were rolling ahead on open prairie. Expectantly, I turned toward my braided seat partner for conversation to be initiated by me, if not him. The straw cowboy hat was pulled down over his eyes. Oh, no! Phooey! And the other word, too. He was sound asleep. I was stymied. Talk about manners and Graham's commandment. I couldn't very well poke a total stranger in the ribs and tell him, "Hey, wake up! I want to palaver with you." That was born-in-the-barn behavior for sure. However, if I accidentally on purpose disturbed his slumber, that was a different matter, right? Retrieving another Mounds from a coat pocket, I noisily unwrapped it, crumpling the wrapper as loudly as possible while I munched away. No result on the sleeper. I coughed huskily. He still didn't stir. Not even working myself into a fake coughing fit penetrated his snooze. I squirmed in my seat, jiggled the armrest between us, made such a wriggling nuisance that I bothered myself. Sleeping Bull, as I now thought of him, never even noticed. The man could have dozed through a cavalry charge. "Well, okay, Red Chief, you better figure this out some," I told myself. After all, the prize sleeper was not the only autograph book candidate and possible conversation partner on the packed dog bus by far. If I wanted Indians, a small tribe of them was scattered up and down the aisle, entire families with little kids in their go-to-town clothes and cowboy-hatted lone men sitting poker-faced but awake, all of them as buckskin-colored as the one parked next to me. Then at the back of the bus, a white-bib work gang, off to some oil field where a gusher had been struck, according to their talk, was having a good time, several of them playing cards on a coat spread across a couple of laps, others looking on and making smart remarks. From snatches I could hear, there wasn't any doubt that I could pick up the finer points of cussing and discussing from them just as I had done with my buddies the soldiers, last seen shouldering their duffel bags to head in the direction of Korea, poor guys. A new gold mine of names and all that came with them was right up there the aisle waiting, if I could only reach it. I gauged my seatmate, who seemed to have expanded in his sleep. Getting by him posed a challenge, but I figured if I stretched myself to just about splitting, I could lift a leg over him into the aisle, and the other leg necessarily would follow. Here goes nothing from nowhere, another of Graham's old standards, got me perilously up, and with one leg spraddled over his round midriff as if mounting a horse from the wrong side, when the fact struck me. Moron, there aren't any empty seats. I'd have to stay standing as I went along the aisle. Already I saw in the rearview mirror that the driver had his eye on me. Defeated, I dropped back into my seat, silently cussing to the limits of my ability. To console myself, I ate my last Mounds. Maybe my luck would change at the next stop, I told myself. Surely the bus would let off some passengers in Chinook, In the meantime, punch drunk on candy, I must have caught the sleeping sickness from my hibernating seatmate as my eyelids grew heavy and the rhythm of the bus wheels on the flat, open road lulled me off into a nap. Only until something happened, I drowsily promised myself. 20-minute stop, folks. The driver's droning announcement that we could disembark if we so wished and take advantage of the convenience of the Greyhound terminal jerked me out of a nightmare. It was one of those bad dreams where you try to hide but never get anywhere. In this case, some big awful building where Wendell Williamson was after me, but every time I ran down a long hallway or up a staircase, he would barge out of a room and demand, "Where's that arrowhead? Hand it over, I'll tell your folks." Groggily, I looked up and down the aisle of the bus, trying to come to grips with my surrounding, then looked again, blinking, to see whether I was still in a dream. Not a good one. The Indians had vanished. Likewise, the oil field crew. The passenger load was down to a precious few. Myself, one of those tourist couples out to see the world on the Jeep, and a man in a gabardine suit of the kind county extension agents and livestock buyers wore. All the rest of the seats, including the one next to me, were empty. I couldn't get my bearings. The bus had already slowed to town speed, but this was no drop stop as Chinook or Fort Belknap would be. I whirled to see out the window to the street. A Stockman bar, a Mint bar, a Rexall drug, a Buttery's grocery, those could be anywhere. Then I spotted a storefront window with the old-fashioned lettering, Glasgow Toggery, Menswear and More. Glasgow. I slept away a sizable portion of Montana. The Indians, including my seatmate, must have got off long since, the oil roughnecks likewise. I felt ridiculously cheated, yet with no one to blame but myself. Staying awake on a once-in-a-lifetime journey should not be that hard a job, I could just about hear Graham chiming in. Kicking myself about all the unfilled pages of the autograph book and the lost chance to palaver about the black arrowhead, I scrambled off for the restroom the moment the bus doors whished open, vowing to get the quick click into action from here on, no matter what it took. When passengers filed on again, things looked more promising. Several fresh faces, although no obvious Indians. I was nothing if not determined, singling out seats I could pop in and out of as the autograph book and I made the rounds. Itching to start, I waited impatiently for the driver to finish some paperwork he was doing on his lap. All at once I saw him look up in surprise, spring the bus door open, and address someone outside. "Afternoon, Sheriff. Prize customer?" "A steady one for damn sure," an irritated voice replied, returning him to the stony lonesome up at Wolf Point again. "He's their prisoner. Supposed to be, anyhow, if the escape artist didn't keep showing up here. I'll catch the local back after I dump him." Sheriff. Prisoner. The stony lonesome, which meant jail. I sat up sharply. Sure enough, up into the bus stepped a rangy man with strong features and a dark, expressive eyebrow and a set mouth as if he were on a mission. He looked like he could carry a six-gun natural as anything and know the right way to use it. He, though, unfortunately, was not the sheriff, according to the handcuffs on his wrists. Right behind him came a sawed-off guy, not much more than half his size, wearing the biggest kind of crow-black Stetson and a star badge. "Here, Romeo," the runty one directed. "Crossing the kid'll do." Oh, man. Not only had my luck changed, the rush of it flattened me back against my seat as the pair of them settled in and the bus started into motion, the prisoner by the window and the sheriff on the aisle. The butt of a revolver protruded out of a well-worn holster on his hip like a place to hang his hat. Noticing me gaping, the sheriff cackled a little. "Getting an eye full of law enforcement there, bucko?" "Yeah. How come you take him by bus?" The lawman grimaced as if he had been asking himself that same question. My deputy's out on a domestic dispute call and the jail's full of orangutan drunks from Saturday night. Not the way I want doing this by hound." He looked around the bus with distaste. "But it'd be just like the master criminal here to bail out of the patrol car if I drove him. Tried that last time, didn't you?" "We weren't going that fast." The sheriff laughed nastily. "Not going to be bailing out of the bus, are you?" "Tell you the truth, I don't see how. Damn right you don't. You're on a one-way ticket back behind bars, and that's that. You needn't be quite so tickled about it. I'm not exactly public enemy number one. You've been hearing another segment from Ivan Doig's Last Bus to Wisdom. That's all the time we have tonight. We're reading with the permission of the publisher, Riverhead Books, an imprint of Penguin Random House. I'm Tom Bacon. Executive producer of The Bookshelf is Vern Wyndham.